5, 1, 9, Ward 6, Dennis F. Sperandio against the Laurelad Tobacco Company.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Bischoff, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Dennis Sperandio, in this case. This is an ERISA case. Mr. Sperandio was a sales representative for Lorelei Tobacco Products. They're a wholesaler distributor of tobacco products, and he was involved in a car accident while he was making deliveries. The two major issues in this case is whether or not the court, the district court, had plenary review or differential review based on the plan itself. The other issue is whether or not Mr. Sperandio was met the definition that would allow him to have long-term disability.
I guess I'm most interested in the second of those, given the fact that the district court was willing to give you the benefit of the doubt on the de novo review point, but nonetheless thought that the record supported a finding that Mr. Sperandio was not disabled for purposes of this plan, that there wasn't enough of this overhead lifting to make a difference. I guess that relates to the shoulder injury, and that the neurological evidence was pretty overwhelmingly against him.
Well, to answer the first part of the question regarding the physical requirements of the job, the physical demands analysis that was filled out by Lorillard at the urging of CNA talks about from floor to ceiling, where they where he has to lift 35 pounds on occasion.
Well, but it says on occasion, and I guess looking at this this description, it's not like every single box has to be lifted from the floor all the way up to the ceiling.
It does say that he does 33% to 66% of the time he's doing the lifting task, and he's lifting from floor
reaching
to ceiling five
shoulders.
Times a day. And if you have a 5-pound limitation for overhead lifting, he's from 21 to 38 pounds, these boxes, that's 4 or 5 times past what he's allowed to carry. I don't know how anybody can lift a box from floor to ceiling without doing the overhead lifting, unless you have a false ceiling and you remove one of the tiles and you climb up the ladder and you put the box there where you're even with the ceiling. But this is overhead lifting, and it's
clearly. Well, CNA suggests maybe he could just use a ladder, just keep it at lower level.
But if it's to the ceiling, I don't. In your heads here, you're still doing the overhead.
Well, you're not putting the box above the ceiling. I mean, the ceiling must be a reference to, not quite abutting it.
Well, I believe that when they say overhead lifting, I mean anything past your shoulder because of the rotator cuff injury and the surgery.
Is there any place in the district court where where Lorillard suggested that a modification of his duties might indeed be possible so that he wouldn't have to do this overhead lifting?
There was
any place in the district court record?
I do not. I think there was a mention by the nurse that looked over the medical and made a determination that there was no disability, that he could possibly take the cigarette boxes or the cigarette cartons out of the box. But he is stocking these stores, and to take the 2-pound cartons out of the boxes, I don't think that's realistic.
But I take that as a no to Judge Ripple's question, that Lorillard itself didn't say that was something he could do. This was the nurse who was the evaluator for CNA.
Right.
So there Lorillard was, never said dismantle the cartons or do anything.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
In fact, in the physical description analysis, it stated, can the job be modified? And it says a case-by-case basis. They also asked if there was another job comparable with this training that would be less physical, and they said no. So here we have a definite question of whether or not this activity, which is clearly stated in the PDA, whether or not he could do this. And it's to lift overhead 21 to 38 pounds is 4 to 5 times the amount that he was restricted to. And that was a permanent restriction by the doctor that performed the surgery, Dr. Zolik. The other areas on the neurological, they go all over. I have to admit that they do go all over the place. But we still have his doctor,
Dr. Lewis doesn't really explain very much, though, why he's done this. And the specialists all seem to think that there's no objective medical evidence of injury, and some of them are skeptical about how reliable his self-reports are.
On the neurological
aspect. On the neurological side, as opposed to the shoulder cuff side.
But we don't have anything other than his doctors, the doctors that his treaters. We have a nurse on the other side that makes a decision that he's not qualified for the long-term disability. So we don't even have, like, the dueling of the experts here. We don't have anybody or independent medical examiner on the other side. We have a nurse that's making this decision.
Based on the records that he's given the company, though, I mean, it's not like she's making a decision on the. With respect, I want to distinguish the shoulder injury from the other, but with respect to his claimed neurological problems, there's a lot of evidence from Dr. Glista, for example, other people who he gave her that fully supports the conclusion.
We also have Dr. Moore. We have Dr. Dr. Glista
Wolf,
does
who also supports the conclusion, saying he only has he's improving. And anyway, the point is, on the neurological side, the package of evidence he gives them supports, seems to me, supports the conclusion that that's not a problem.
Well, based on the plenary review, I don't think it would pass muster on a plenary review. Maybe differential, but not the.
Well, we would have to say Dr. Lewis trumped everybody, and I don't know why you would say that about a general doctor as opposed to the specialists.
Well, I think he trumps the nurse.
But the other doctors, the other doctors in the record.
Okay.
Anyway, well, we'll take a look at it, of course.
The other issue, if the court cares, I will go into the issue on the whether it should be plenary or differential. I could save that for rebuttal because I'm sure the other side will bring that up.
As you wish.
You can do it either way, counsel. Your white light is on, so you are beginning to get near the end of the time. If you'd like to wait and say something on rebuttal,
that would be my preference, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bischoff. We'll hear now from Ms. Dua.
Good morning to the panel, counsel. My name is Elizabeth Doolin. My colleague Julie Wall is with me at counsel's table. I'm here representing CNA. Before I begin my remarks, I would like to address some of the issues that the court went over with counsel. With respect to the overhead lifting, frankly, with respect to the entire case, the first thing that the court does need to do, or CNA needed to do under the deferential standard of review that we believe applies, is to look at the language of the contract. And what the policy and the certificate state is that in order for there to be a disability, Mr. Sparendio had to be disabled from performing the material and substantial duties of his occupation. So the first thing the district court did is say, is overhead lifting of a cigarette case a material or substantial duty? Is he doing it enough that it's absolutely something that could be considered a material and substantial duty?
But the problem, I guess I want to just throw two problems out. One of them is the unfortunate absence in the district court's opinion of any focus on the 5-pound overhead restriction, because one can read the PDA as making it seem like this has to happen a lot, in which case, you know, 30% of the time or so, in which case it probably is a material and substantial part of the job, or maybe you don't have to read it that way, but without the district court having focused on that, it's very hard to say. So that's the first point. The second is, I know you rely on Ruiz and Scheinman and cases for the standard of review, but there's a very important difference in this case, which is the fact that the SDA in the certificate, the summary plan description, SPD, specifically says it's not part of the policy. Now, we start with the language. People write policies however they want them, but if they say in a summary plan description or in a certificate, this is for your information only, it's not part of the plan, it's not part of the policy, then it isn't part of the plan. And I think that was Judge Leinenweber's primary reason for finding in the final analysis that whatever discretionary language there was in these certificates didn't control ultimately. If you want to redraft your plan to change it, obviously people redraft plans a lot, but I think that's where the de novo standard comes from. It's not like Ruiz said, it's discretionary no matter what the plan says. You have to look at each language.
Well, let me answer your second question first, if I may, because I think it'll impact certainly the overall analysis. And first of all, I think there is a misapprehension in counsel's reply brief in particular, equating the policy with the plan. In this case, I recognize there is that language. There was also that language in the Mullally decision, which was reconsidered and overturned in light of this court's decisions in Diaz and Ruiz.
But that's just a district court decision. This court has never said disregard language that says this isn't part of the plan.
I understand, Your Honor. And the other thing I would point to is language in the certificate that does provide that the policy, the application, the certificate of coverage, and other attached papers form the contract between the parties. That's at page 22 of the policy record, Your Honor.
But the contract between the parties isn't necessarily the same thing as the ERISA plan.
But, Your Honor, as the court recognized in Ruiz, a plan document can be something other than and not only the policy.
I don't disagree with that, but the plan, that the certificate in Ruiz didn't contain language like the language we have in this one. So there's no reason to think this court was ruling on language not before it.
I understand that, Your Honor. I would submit that in this case, when you have the language I just referred to in the certificate, when the policy is essentially a single piece of paper that sets forth, here's our obligation to provide insurance coverage to this employer, that's our policy.
So why does it? But you're asking us to disregard this sentence, quote, this certificate is not the capital P policy. It is merely evidence of insurance provided under the policy.
I understand.
What happens to that sentence?
Your Honor, that sentence is significant for delineating the policy from the other plan documents, but that sentence does not say this certificate is not a plan document. And I think what Diaz recognizes is that when plan documents contain the necessary language providing for discretionary authority, and the certificate is what, per its terms, is distributed by CNA to the employer for distribution to the employees, along with the summary plan description, it meets the requirements in Diaz that notice is given to the employee of its employee's rights.
It's pretty miserable notice if it's that confusing, because you've got the SPD saying it's, quote, not, quote, a part of the plan nor of any insurance policy issued in connection to it. So that takes care of the SPD language. And then there's this language. At best, you wind up with contradictory signals, which is not very good for notice. I don't know why it matters to you that much. I mean, you won in the district court under de novo review.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. And we would submit, and as we did in our briefs, that under de novo review, the evidence still goes overwhelmingly in favor of no disability in this case. And perhaps this is my opportunity to address your second question, which is that the point counsel makes about the PDA not saying anything about Mr. Sparandio being able to alter the way he does his job I think is a little bit inaccurate. The PDA provides a range of jobs that Mr. Sprendio is required to do. It is not an exhaustive, detailed list of all the ways that Mr. Sprendio can perform that job. But what is important is that the language of the policy does require that the definition of material and substantial duties includes the idea that a material and substantial duty is one where a necessary and function of your regular occupation which cannot be reasonably omitted or altered. Under either standard of review, it is entirely reasonable to say that when Mr. Sprendio is going to the convenience store he goes to make a delivery, he can open up that case of cigarettes if he's faced with a circumstance where he needs to lift that case overhead.
But where did Lorillard ever say that? I think Judge Ripple had a good question there. I mean, it's fine for counsel on appellate argument to say this, but doesn't he need some signal from the employer?
I think you can look at the PDA and see that the PDA describes very generally this is what's required. It also doesn't say that Mr. Sprendio is required to overhead lift with his hands, or Mr. Sprendio is required to overhead lift in some other way. It's general. It's not an exhaustive, detailed catalog of every possible way that Mr. Sprendio can do his job. But it's entirely appropriate for CNA, looking at the language of this contract, which says that in order for something to be a material and substantial duty, it can't be reasonably omitted and altered, to say, we're looking at the PDA, we see what's required, not just generally overhead lifting, but specifically cases that contain cartons. The PDA even told us that a carton weighs 2 pounds. So there was information provided from Lorillard that allowed CNA and the district court, depending on which standard of review you want to apply, to reasonably determine that, yes, this is something that reasonably could be done in order to make Mr. Sprendio's occupation doable in his particular condition.
In ruling on these matters, what does CNA do when it has either ambiguous information or no information at all? Let's say it just simply doesn't know what the employee has to do. What do you do about that?
Well, Your Honor, I think this particular record is silent on that. I would think that in general, if it needed information about what this employee needs to do his job, it would request that information from the employer. As counsel noted, the PDA was a form that Lorillard provided at the request of or as required by CNA. So it is in the position to get that information if it needs it. The question here is, did it need it? And I would submit that it did not. The PDA gave an accurate and comprehensive description of the ranges and types of motions that Mr. Sprendio needed to do his job. And focusing on the PDA, CNA and the district court were both reasonable in saying he can do his job within those restrictions, either because overhead lifting was not part of the substantial and material duties of his regular occupation, or if it was, it could be performed with a reasonable modification. Your Honors, with respect to the final issue regarding the neurological impairment of Mr. Sprendio, I would just reiterate what Judge Wood said. The evidence in this case was overwhelming. The physician who treated Mr. Sprendio the longest concluded he could work. For this reason, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Doolin. How much time does Mr. Bischoff have? Sir, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would like to point to the second page of the PDA, where it says reaching above shoulders, which is 66% of the time. I would say that is pretty substantial.
Does it say that? I mean, in your brief, you say, this is on page 7, for 33 to 66% of the workday, Sprendio must stoop, kneel, crouch, handle, grasp, turn, reach below shoulders and above shoulders, twist head, neck, blah, blah, blah. And so it doesn't sound to me like only the above shoulders happens 66% of the time. It's this whole set of functions, of which some undisclosed percentage is above shoulders. That's what you quoted anyway in your brief.
Right.
So I just don't want to overstate what the record says about how much of the time the above shoulders activity is happening.
Also, what I think that the court should know is that Mr. Sparandio works alone. He makes these deliveries by himself. And if he's required to lift those boxes overhead, I don't think he can ask the customer to do that for him. And I don't think that the customer authorizes him to take the product out of the boxes unless it's ready for display. And that's where they come with the 2-pound weight on the cartons when he's preparing these displays and taking the product out of the boxes. The court brought up the point about the language is not clear. This isn't part of the plan. This isn't part of the policy. But that's where they have the discretionary authority couched. Herzberger is very clear. You're supposed to tell the participant, tell them clearly about what they have. This is a non-contributory plan. If Mr. Sparandio knew that he would have to go through this, he would have been able to get another policy himself, because he doesn't have to look to his employer to help contribute to the plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. The case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to all counsel.